Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a long, hopefully fruitful and sunny Labor Day weekend. And just to put you in the mood, I have a particularly challenging talk for you today. This very day, and indeed this weekend, comprise Bernanke's finest hour, and we're all cringing, wondering what nonsense will emanate from his pie hole, I'm going to spend the majority of today's hour discussing in a lot of detail why he is so gravely out of touch with what happened in the Great Depression. Well, this is Friday, the 31st of August, our last day at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We shall be meeting again at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 a.m. Singapore Time, for those trusty souls who will stay up and burn the 2 a.m. oil to listen to me, which I should think will be roughly zero people. But anyway, Monday is a holiday. There won't be any talk on Monday. So I will have an interesting book, e-book, for you to read over the weekend for those on the email list. So prepare yourself for plenty of entertainment, if you are that way inclined, from the wake-up call. Okay, well, it's a measure of the profound stupidity of the man that Bernanke is utterly oblivious to the signals and messages being sent to us by the terrible events of the Great Depression. You know, very few people really understand why Bernanke is so wrong about things. And I intend to put that right today for you, ladies and gentlemen. You know, Bernanke's own brand of arrogance and vapid and weak grasp of the essentials of what brought the country to its knees appears to me to result from a mixture of simple ignorance combined with a powerful dose of political bias and sappy and woolly thinking based on only the most superfluous intellectual input. With all his scholarly study of the Great Depression, Professor Bernanke is blind to several truly major factors that caused it. Now, as you will hear from what I have to say, there really were people of that epoch who did see with blinding clarity what was happening. And just like today, they were ignored, both at the time and subsequently by people like Bernanke, who should have known better in hindsight and with the benefit of historical perspective. See, his is a blindness that he shares with very many other economists of this day and age. Their condition can be described as a certain state of mind that they share that prevents them from seeking out the truth, seeing as they do and saying only what is directly before their eyes and ears. And what is this state of mind? It is quite simply to defend the status quo and to stay within the comfortable bounds of conventional beliefs that support the system such as it is. This spares them, of course, you see, from confronting other institutions, and indeed their own. Because of this state of mind, Bernanke doesn't see or speak of the common features between the latest banking and real estate fiasco and America's Great Depression, nor, for that matter, features common to most other of America's economic collapses and depressions. These are fractional reserve banking, bank financing of real estate and stock speculation, and, of course, our old friend, financial fraud. By contrast, let me spend a little bit of time here pointing to the work of Professor Herbert D. Simpson, whom we shall examine in some detail, and I'm prepared to bet that 100% of you have no idea who this man is or was. But in a 1933 article in the American Economic Review, he emphasized these very banking and real estate factors that I've just mentioned as bringing on the Great Depression. We now can see that they do reappear in the recent past. Simpson's article is entitled Real Estate Speculation and the Depression. He relates that the 1920s were a period of what he calls sensational real estate speculation. This is a fact that he takes as given, but he merely gives one example, and I quote, "In Cook County outside Chicago, we had in 1928 151,000 improved lots and 335,000 vacant. On the basis of our Regional Plan Commission's estimates of future population increase, it will take until 1960 to absorb the vacant lots already subdivided in 1928. In fact, on the basis of these computations, we shall still have 25,000 of these vacant lots already subdivided in 1928, and we shall still have them for sale in the summer of 1960. In one township, Niles Township, we have a population of 9,000 and enough vacant lots for a population of 190,000. End of quote. Well, in support of Simpson, the Baker Library at Harvard writes of the forgotten real estate boom of the 1920s, stating, and I quote, "The famous stock market bubble of 1925 to 1929 has been closely analyzed. Less well known and far less well documented is the nationwide real estate bubble that began around 1921 and deflated around 1926. End of quote. Most accounts of the 1920s mention this boom, but it has not yet influenced the thought of most modern economists. They prefer other stories, such as that of Friedman and Schwartz, which blames the Fed for not inflating. Actually, it did inflate, as Gary North explains. Even though real estate is a sector of economy-wide importance, today's economists tend to ignore its functioning because of the relative lack of data. Real estate hardly rates an entry in a macroeconomics textbook. They have been also trained to put on blinders and ignore land ever since neoclassical economics invalidly collapsed land as a factor into capital. Furthermore, another part of their state of mind is to think only in terms of aggregate demand, a sort of blanket under which the real estate market and real estate speculation lie submerged and hidden. There is an inbuilt bias against overt criticism of American real estate speculation, such as the love and admiration America holds for the idea of home ownership. Mustn't frighten the little darlings away, you see. Simpson's views were supported only recently in a 2010 paper by William Goetzmann and Frank Newman entitled Securitization in the 1920s. The study backs up Simpson's conclusion that there had been rampant real estate speculation. Goetzmann and Newman write, and I quote, "The present crisis is not the first time that the real estate securities market has expanded to the brink of collapse. The U.S. real estate securities market was remarkably complex through the first few decades of the 20th century. Many parallels with the modern market can be observed. The early real estate development industry fed the first retail appetite for real estate securities. Consequently, easily obtainable financing via public capital markets corresponded with an urban construction boom. Ultimately, the size, scope, and complexity of the 1920s real estate market undermined its merits, causing a crash not unlike the one underpinning our current financial crisis." End of quote. Now, it's a terrible pity, isn't it, that Messrs. Goetzmann and Newman couldn't have said these things before the recent real estate boom. But as I've just said, America was not ready to hear it until, of course, the damage had been done. The mention of an urban construction boom by this study is what Simpson mentions in his paper 79 years earlier, and I quote, "Our latest speculative movement differs from all previous speculative eras in the United States in the fact that it has been distinctly an urban field of speculation." Another recent article that compares the 1920s to the present is Eugene White's Lessons from the Great American Real Estate Boom and Bust of the 1920s, and I quote, "Although long obscured by the Great Depression, the nationwide bubble that appeared in the early 1920s and burst in 1926 was similar in magnitude to the recent real estate boom and bust. Fundamentals, including a post-war construction catch-up, low interest rates, and a Greenspan put, helped to ignite the boom in the 20s, but alternative monetary policies would have only dampened, not eliminated it. Both booms were accompanied by securitization, a reduction in lending standards, and weaker supervision. Yet the bust in the 20s, which drove up foreclosures, did not induce a collapse of the banking system. The elements absent in the 1920s were federal deposit insurance, the too-big-to-fail doctrine, and federal policies to increase mortgages to higher-risk homeowners. This comparison suggests that these factors combined to induce increased risk-taking that was crucial to the eruption of the recent and worst financial crisis since the Great Depression." End of quote. Well, White is correct that deposit insurance, too big to fail, and federal policies have made the present situation worse than the 1920s, other things being equal. A pervasive 1920s real estate boom or bubble is consistent with the Austrian analysis in which the banking system produces fiduciary money, lowers interest rates, and flows it into assets of long duration whose values are particularly sensitive to interest rate fluctuations. Simpson's analysis beautifully weaves several threads together into one simple fabric. The central thread is fractional reserve banks that finance long-term assets with short-term deposits. Let's hear some more of what Simpson has to say, and I quote, "Now, when it is recalled that these were not mortgage banks organized on principles of long-term financing, investing their own capital funds and free from deposit liabilities, but that they ordinarily purported to be commercial banks engaged in accumulating and carrying large deposits, and that their operations were financed largely through the funds of their depositors, it will be realized in what a highly overextended position this segment of our banking system was placed. End of quote. Today's banks operate on the same principle of borrowing excessively short and lending excessively long. The modern system developed an additional layer known as the shadow banking system, but it too financed excessive amounts of long-term assets with excessive amounts of short-term liabilities. This has two dangers. One is that the long-term assets fall in value by more than the value of the short-term liabilities, which means, quite simply, the bank is insolvent. The other is that the bank cannot roll over its short-term debts, which happens when the lenders see that the bank is insolvent. Ladies and gentlemen, both of these things happened in both booms. Let me continue to quote Simpson. All the financial resources of existing banking and financial institutions were utilized to the full in financing this speculative movement. The insurance companies bought what they considered the choicer mortgages. Conservative banks loaned freely on real estate mortgages, and less conservative banks and financial houses loaned on almost everything else that represented real estate in any form. Eventually, we reached a point where most of the city and outlying banks of the country were loaded with real estate loans or real estate liabilities of some sort. Not all of these loans were speculative. Many of them were intrinsically sound and conservative. But a large, probably a major portion of this loan structure depended for its solvency upon a continuation of the rate of absorption and turnover which had characterized the real estate market and on a continued advance of real estate values. When the rate of absorption halted and the price movement stopped, one of the largest categories of bank collateral in the country went stale, and the banks found themselves loaded with frozen assets, which we have been trying ever since to thaw out. End of quote. I mean, this stuff really could have been written yesterday afternoon at 4 p.m., couldn't it? You know, deposit insurance paid for by banks looks as if it curtails the rollover problem, but it doesn't. It works only in good times because the deposit insurance fund is too small to handle systemic problems. Worse yet, deposit guarantees allow and encourage banks to become larger and, with lax regulation, more overextended. The basic problem is holding excessive amounts of long-term assets that are financed by excessive amounts of short-term liabilities. And it just metastasizes. You can see this quite clearly with the recent problems and the unprecedented responses of the government. In the latest crisis, the federal government stepped in to guarantee money market funds, both retail and institutional. It also began financing banks through the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. The FDIC got involved in financing banks through the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, or TLGP. The Fed did all sorts of financing, including a commercial paper funding facility and special funding for some financial intermediaries like AIG and Bear Stearns. Simpson's article views the banks and their real estate financing as a major cause of the subsequent depression. And again, I quote, "We do not have all the facts and figures, and in the nature of things, probably we'll never have them. But it would seem that we can safely say this much, that real estate securities, and real estate affiliations in some form have been the largest single factor in the failure of the 4,800 banks that have closed their doors during the past 3 years and in the frozen condition of a large proportion of the banks whose doors are still open. And that as the facts of our banking history of the past 3 years come to light more and more, it becomes increasingly apparent that our banking collapse during the present depression has been largely a real estate collapse." End of quote. You know, you have to fight very hard to remember that this stuff was not written last week, don't you? And Bernanke in all this? Oh, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, I'm coming to Bernanke. Don't worry. Bernanke never escapes the wake-up call. Trust me on that one. A boom, by definition, involves an expansion. The expansion process is not what causes a boom, but it helps us to perceive the parallels between the 1920s and now, to observe that the expansion process was similar in the past and the present. In the real estate boom of the 1990s and 2000s, we saw not only the existing banks and institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac become more aggressive, we also saw new kinds of financial intermediaries spring up. New kinds of financing methods were also used to create mortgages, package them, and distribute them to investors aggressively. These developments are not unlike those in the 1920s. Simpson again. A particularly ominous development was the expansion of the banking system itself for the specific purpose of financing real estate promotion and development. Real estate interests dominated the policies of many banks, and thousands of new banks were organized and chartered for the specific purpose of providing the credit facilities for proposed real estate promotions. The greater proportion of these were state banks and trust companies, many of them located in the outlying sections of the larger cities, or in suburban regions not fully occupied by older and more established banking institutions. In the extent to which their deposits and resources were devoted to the exploitation of real estate promotions being carried on by controlling or associated interests, these banks commonly stopped short of nothing but the criminal law, and sometimes not short even of that. End of quote. Simpson, of course, is alluding to illegality and fraud. These, too, were a serious part of the 1990s and 2000s. All right, let's take a quick break for my information, and then we'll get to Bernanke. 888-874-4888 is your toll-free number waiting for you. Well, actually, probably not today because I've got a lot more to talk about, but that's the toll-free number. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, gfawd.com for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. If you want to call me direct, you may do so. My number is 941, area code 441-1682. That's if you want to talk to me about your personal situation. You can call me in Sarasota, come straight through to Singapore. Again, the number is area code 941-441-1682. All right, well, just those of you who were not listening on Monday, please be aware that the next meetup group will be on Sunday, September the 30th at 2 p.m. usual place, usual venue, George Street Ale House, 371 George Street, and Jack will again be the moderator, and his number is 914-414-6940. So please call him and evidence your interest in turning up at that venue at the time to talk about issues concerned with life or maybe no life in the United States. Very important. You will all benefit from it. Once more, Jack's number, please let him know you're coming. Jack Trevesta is at 914-414-6940. And lastly, just to let you know, there will be no live show on Monday. It is Labor Day, and PRN will be taking a well-deserved rest. So, now we come to Ben Bernanke, who we are asked to believe knew nothing of all of the things that I have just mentioned. Totally ignorant, did his PhD, was a specialist in the Great Depression. And yet, amazingly enough, he knew nothing about the real estate problems of the time. Well, in the American Economic Review, he published a paper entitled Non-Monetary Effects of the Financial Crisis in the Propagation of the Great Depression. Well, this paper is not intended to examine the causes of the Great Depression, and indeed it does not do so. It's about what he calls the depression's propagation. Bernanke points out that, quote, the disruption of the financial sector by the banking and debt crises raised the real cost of intermediation between lenders and certain classes of borrowers, end of quote. He means that the credit market slowed down to a crawl, and again, I quote, fear of runs led to large withdrawals of deposits, precautionary increase in reserve deposit ratios, and an increased desire by banks for very liquid or rediscountable assets. These factors, plus the actual failures, forced a contraction of the banking system's role in the intermediation of credit. End of quote. 25 years later, Bernanke was in a position in a new banking crisis to replace a new set of failed intermediaries with the Federal Reserve. In the intervening years, the non-Austrian economics profession had done nothing to focus on the causes of the banking failures, and nothing to educate government officials about how to remedy those causes. And despite not having sought or found the causes of the depression, Bernanke was quite happy to take the position that the so-called financial structure lacked, as he said, self-correcting powers. Or, in other words, that the free market had failed. He confidently announced instead, quote, that the federally directed financial rehabilitation, which took strong measures against the problems of both creditors and debtors, was the only major New Deal program that successfully promoted economic recovery, unquote. And he argued that, quote, the government's actions set the financial system on its way back to health, end of quote. On what basis could Bernanke possibly know what a healthy bank looked like without analyzing what an unhealthy bank looked like and how it got that way, namely by excessively financing real estate loans with short-term deposits flowing through the banking system due to a generous Federal Reserve? On what basis did Bernanke think he could blame banks for being reluctant to lend when A, they were insolvent, and B, business was poor due to such benighted federal policies as Hoover's efforts to keep wages high, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and a bevy of major New Deal programs, some of which strengthened trade unions and held wages up? On what grounds was Bernanke blithely able to extol government for having, quote, made investments in the shares of thrift institutions and substituted for recalcitrant private institutions in the provision of direct credit, In 1934, the government-sponsored Homeowners Loan Corporation made 71% of all mortgage loans extended. End of quote. None of these government actions resolved the basic banking and money problems. All of them socialized finance. All of them led to new problems, including the establishment of Fannie Mae in 1938. In 1995, Bernanke published The Macroeconomics of the Great Depression, A Comparative Approach, in the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking. He began by saying that, quote, to understand the Great Depression is the holy grail of macroeconomics, unquote. As in his 1983 paper, however, Bernanke just refuses to conflate the 1930s with the 1920s. He tells us that, quote, finding an explanation for the worldwide economic collapse of the 1930s remains a fascinating intellectual challenge, unquote. But apparently it's not fascinating enough to examine the effects of the real estate and stock market booms of the 1920s, or entertain the Austrian theory of malinvestment, or reference Rothbard's America's Great Depression, or examine the structure of banks, or think about the integration of the world economy via its banks and capital markets. So what then is Bernanke's understanding of the Great Depression? It is, and I quote, that monetary shocks played a major role in the Great Contraction, and that these shocks were transmitted around the world primarily through the workings of the gold standard. End of quote. By monetary shocks, he means that the money supply contracted. We already know that this happened when the banking system became insolvent. It raises several pertinent questions that Bernanke ignores. Did the money supply grow excessively in the 1920s before it contracted? And why did the banking system become insolvent? What did they invest in? And how did they finance those investments such that they eventually became insolvent? Rothbard and Benjamin M. Anderson both show that money grew rapidly in the 1920s, and, as explained, so did the bank's investment in real estate. In Economics and the Public Welfare, Anderson writes, the purchase of approximately $500 million worth of government securities by the Federal Reserve banks, the total deposits of the member banks increased from $28,270,000 on March the 31st, 1924, to $32,457,500,000 on June the 30th, 1925, an increase of over $4 billion. This additional bank credit was not needed by commerce, and it went preponderantly into securities, in part into direct bond purchases by the banks, and in part into stock and bond collateral loans. It also went into real estate mortgages purchased by banks, and in part into installment finance paper. This immense expansion of credit, added to the ordinary sources of capital, created the illusion of unlimited capital. And he also writes, there is no need whatever to be doctrinaire in objecting to the employment of bank credit for capital purposes, so long as the growth of this is kept proportionate to the growth of the industry of the country. But when in the period 1924 to 1929 there came an extraordinary spurt of this kind of employment of bank funds, and when commercial loans began going down in the banks at the same time that the stock market loans and bank holdings of bonds were mounting rapidly, the careful observer grew alarmed. And when, in addition, there came a startling increase of several 100% in bank holdings of real estate mortgages, the thing seemed extremely ominous. End of quote. as for Bernanke's statement about the workings of the gold standard, there was no traditional gold standard in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a gold exchange standard. If a standard is to be blamed, it is the latter, not the gold standard. Murray Rothbard has explained the inflationary workings of the gold exchange standard. Another source is the Great Depression by Lionel Robbins. Both emphasize Great Britain's futile attempt to peg the pound at its old gold parity. Bernanke, of course, doesn't reference either Rothbard or Robbins. Bernanke doesn't mention the key bank failure in 1931 that helped to propagate the depression, Kreditanstalt. The American money supply had been declining prior to this failure, and it accelerated its decline thereafter. This failure appears to have been a shock that cannot be ignored. Kreditanstalt was the largest bank in Austria and owned about 60% of Austrian industry. It had grown in size due to a large but bad merger. The Austrian economy had had problems from at least 1924. Behind the scenes, a British and American consortium of banks had been secretly funneling funds to Kreditanstalt, and its failure led to a run on the Austrian shilling. It appears that the gold exchange standard had little or nothing to do with these events. There are several other seeds to the Great Depression. They include the Smoot-Hawley tariff, Hoover's high wage policies, and others of his policies that eventually became New Deal policies. I also believe that the Depression became worldwide because the economy was worldwide as it is today. And European countries had banking and other problems that trace back to World War I and its aftermath. On October the 15th, 2008, Bernanke said in a prepared speech, and I quote, "As in all past crises, at the root of the problem is a loss of confidence by investors and the public in the strength of key financial institutions and markets. The crisis will end when comprehensive responses by political and financial leaders restore that trust, bringing investors back into the market and allowing the normal business of extending credit to households and firms to resume." End of quote. This, you see, is typical of Bernanke's thought, which habitually stops short at asking why events occur. If he kept asking why, he might eventually get to the heart of the matter. Why has there been a loss of confidence? It didn't just happen. What brought it about? Didn't investors have good reason to question key banks and investment banks? Wasn't there good reason why credit spreads had risen? Hadn't housing prices started to drop? Those declines were real. They cannot be blamed on a loss of confidence. Why had housing prices declined? Was it perhaps because there had been a housing boom fueled by federal policies and readily available bank loans? And perhaps because there had been a housing boom reaching prices at unsustainable levels? He doesn't ask. Don't ask, don't tell. Bernanke has that certain state of mind by which he cuts inquiry short, never going beyond the superficial, because to do so would bring him onto the ground which to him is dangerous. He might have to condemn fractional reserve banking or endemic fraud in the mortgage industry or his own institution or lax federal regulation. So instead, Bernanke blames the panic of 2008 on a loss of confidence in banks and markets and tries to get us to believe that the remedy is a restoration of trust. And that's only one of his superficial explanations. The main one is the same one he thinks, or he says he thinks, caused the Great Depression. He thinks, or says he thinks, that the central bank didn't create enough money in the 1930s, when the truth is almost the very opposite. Inflation of money in the 1920s worked its way through the banking system and into an unsustainable real estate boom and stock market bubble. The problem wasn't too little money, it was too much. The world experienced a repetition of this high money growth between 2002 and 2008, and before, as I have shown elsewhere. Another real estate bubble occurred. We are now living in its aftermath. Bernanke's additions of huge amounts of base money, which are his solutions, do not solve the basic problems, which are the structure of banks and the structure of fiat money. Ultimately, and unfortunately, Bernanke's blindness is not unique among today's economists. Many of them believe the same thing. Several Federal Reserve presidents are prepared to inject even more base money into the American and world economy. There is no money supply reason for doing so, because the money supply has already soared in the last few years. There is no reason relative to the economy for doing so, because the soaring money supply has had negligible effects on economic growth and unemployment. These bankers seem to have gone Bernanke one better. He is blind, but they've taken complete leave of their senses. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you go. That's what I have for you in terms of something to support one's own view of the craziness of Bernanke and his cohorts. Let's take a break now. It's a little bit late, but let's take it, and then I'll be right back. Well, I'm assuming that we are back, and while I was talking to you in the first 45 minutes of our show, history has been made in the markets. And Kevin Moran has been kind enough to update me, and so I shall report on what I'm being told. First of all, stocks jumped 100 Dow points ahead of our friend Bernanke's speech. And, when it was discovered that Mr. Bernanke was not going to do anything, the Dow dropped 80 points, or 100, in 10 minutes. I mean, truly, we are dealing here with a bunch of people who are treating money just like heroin. They think that the only good thing that can come of what Bernanke does is if he actually injects more money into the system. They have no idea what they're talking about. They have no idea why. They don't know how it can help. It hasn't helped up until now, but they've decided that that's what's needed, and if he does not produce the goods, they will sell the stock market. It's like a come down. It's like withdrawal. It's unbelievable that these people are so ignorant and so foolish and so out of touch with historical parallels that they can think this way. But they clearly do. And so, basically, there's nothing we can do about it. We've just got to live with it. And trust me, ladies and gentlemen, as I sit here talking to you today, it is going to end terribly, terribly, terribly badly. Worse than any comparable period in history. There isn't a comparable period. It's far worse than the Depression of the 1930s. So anyway, let's look at an email from Judy Alicia, as I see it here, who says, "Dear Richard, do you not believe Bernanke and his bankster ilk are knowingly manipulating and profiting from running the world financial system into the ground?" Honestly, no, I'm glad you asked that question, Judy, because There are two things. First of all, and I've said them both before, these people are much too stupid to orchestrate such a successful outcome. I mean, they do not understand what they're doing. If Bernanke had understood and wanted really to drive the financial system into the ground, he wouldn't be throwing more money into the system because it doesn't work. It doesn't achieve anything. It isn't that it achieves something which is worse than if he didn't do anything at all. It achieves precisely nothing. Putting money into the system by Bernanke is the equivalent of taking that money and burying it in the ground. It's not being used. It has no possible utility in the system, either good or bad. It's just nonsense. It's just, you know, people will buy stocks because they think there's going to be inflation or hyperinflation. They have no idea why they think that. They wouldn't stand up to 10 minutes if confronted by one of the greats like Rothbard or Mises. But no, that's what Bernanke does, and that's what they think is going to work. And so Bernanke makes himself a few more friends, and basically that's all there is to it, Judy. There's nothing to do with manipulation. He's not trying to drive the system into the ground. Why would he do that? It wouldn't help him. It wouldn't help his cronies. No, I don't think there's any of that going on. Just blatant stupidity. And I never understand why people refuse to face this. We're dealing with very, very, very stupid people. I keep saying this, and I don't get anybody who supports my point of view. I must tell you, I get every time I mention this, I get a slew of emails from people who think, who politely accuse me of being naive. I'm sorry, I don't think that is the case. I think that, first of all, you can't manipulate a system as big as the monetary system of the world. It can't be done. Oh yes, there are a lot of people who write tracts in blogs and newspapers and have radio shows that talk about this kind of thing. They're wasting their breath. It can't happen. The system is just too enormous. They can't even manipulate the world currency systems. It's too big. I've been involved in the currency systems. I know it can't be done. It can be done maybe for 15 minutes. And then when they run out of ammunition, the currency markets simply just go on doing whatever they were doing before. So they really don't have the power that's ascribed to them, Judy. And I don't think that it's helpful to you or a proper understanding of your case to pursue that line of thought. All right. Here's an email. Thank you for the email. That was good of you to write that in, Judy. An email from Thor Dockweiler in Los Angeles, who says, "Dear Richard, now that we the people have suffered through the first week of two different ice cream flavors topped by clowns, one has to just stay shocked at how these zombie politicians have turned our world into a cube. No matter what way you sail, a cliff edge is real close. If I back up my tunnel vision of this one viper pit, I see a second pit for next week. If I back up further, I see that these pits are the eyes of a two-headed snake. The worst part is that they have said their lies so much, so often, that they actually believe what they're saying. Sound familiar? What is hysterical is that VP candidate Ryan likes to listen to AC/DC, to Zeppelin, and especially Rage Against the Machine. Obviously trying to get the young person's vote, except he is part of the machine even by that band's own response. Politicians here in the U.S., Richard, are like a pot of beans. It would be nice to say that we get the best, but for those familiar with cooking, one observes after a while the scum floats to the top. It was nice to see that there were both men and women in this Republican National Convention. The only problem I saw was almost everybody was white. I thought the U.S. by now would be more cubed. Scary, really, if you ask me. Cheers, Richard. Thor Dockweiler, Los Angeles." I am afraid somebody has competition, and I think that somebody knows who he is. Thor, thank you for the email. Okay, an email from Truett Allday. Richard, just curious on how you think firms that invest in emerging markets will do in the coming years. I have been investigating Leonard Capital, a fund that primarily invests in Southeast Asian markets that have little or no ties to Western economies, which is one of their reasons that they will do well once things fall apart in the Western world. Anyway, just curious of your thoughts. Thanks, Truett. Well, Truett, the first thing you do need to understand is that this website, which I did look at quickly, is a company specialized in selling funds. So of course they're going to be bullish on the things they sell. I never yet saw a gold company say, sorry folks, but gold's probably going to go down for the next couple of years. Don't look at our funds. Try something else like treasury bills instead. It's not going to happen to it. You can't trust these people. You have to look when you are trying to assess the future of a segment or a market area or a stock or a bond or a fund. You have to try to go to people who have no axe to grind one way or the other. There you are much more likely to get a reasoned opinion. When these people have no interest in pushing something for the sake of making money out of it. So I think emerging markets, to answer your question, will do well. Yes, I think they will do well in the coming years. But I think that they will do very, very badly in the meantime. This is what you would call a valley. And we have to traverse this valley. We've got to go through it. This is important. We've got to go through the valley and come out the other side. And you don't want to be panicked out of investments at the bottom of the valley because you think it's going to go lower. So no, stay out of all forms of investments for the time being, Truett. You don't want to get caught in being right, but at the same time losing money. That's not going to work. So I would say, yes, study the emerging markets, get your information together, but don't invest at this point. Wait a few years until things really collapse and unravel, and then you will be in a much better position to get involved with such investments. And they will be the right investments. I'm absolutely convinced you're right. Just don't be too early, that's all. Well, it looks like the fall of Morgan Stanley. I got a heads up from Anne, who sent me interesting information. I used to work with Morgan Stanley, so this is actually an unfortunate reality that looks like it's coming our way. Morgan Stanley, its stock price has been falling for years, as some of you will know, but its stock price seems to have started to fall in earnest on the New York Stock Exchange. And according to Rick Wiles, and I quote, I'm hearing rumors that another major financial house is going to implode. In fact, the name I've been given is Morgan Stanley. It's going to be put on the sacrificial altar by the financial elite, end of quote. Well, if you take a close look at Morgan Stanley, you will see that, technically speaking, it is classified as insolvent based on mark-to-market valuation. And by selling off non-core assets, Morgan Stanley has been able to reduce its European exposure through the manipulation of hedge funds and allocation of funds to failing financial corporations. And some mainstream media outlets tout that the Federal Reserve will come in and assist Morgan Stanley in their insolvency, and that Morgan Stanley just isn't going to go out of business anytime soon. However, on the bond market, Morgan Stanley is being treated like a junk-rated company. Moody's, the rating agency that sells their ratings to whoever will pay for a AAA score, have announced that they will downgrade Morgan Stanley's ratings, which would put all U.S. banks at risk. And Otis Cassett, or Cassay, however you pronounce his name, director of credit research at Market, confirms this, and I quote, what has driven that, obviously, is Europe. The perception is, correctly or incorrectly, that Morgan Stanley is one of the U.S. banks most exposed to Europe's problems. which, by the way, I didn't know. I didn't actually know that, but I'm not surprised, because I remember when I worked there that they were investing money right, left, and center. Anybody who was asked for money sort of got some. It was the era of venture capital financing, and Morgan Stanley was not slow to contribute. So, you know, with the arrogance that these big companies think that everything they touch will turn to gold, I've no doubt that they did feel that their investments were a good bet. But as I told you, ladies and gentlemen, all of these elements are going to come home to roost together, and they are going to cause an outrageous meltdown in markets, in economies, in countries. Europe right now is just pathetic. I cannot even tell you what a sorry story it is to hear these people like Mario Draghi and Rajoy of Spain and Herman Van Rompuy all talking about what's going to happen and how Germany apparently wants to stay away from all this. I don't blame them. Germany is having its own problems right now. I mean, you know, it's a very, very sad state of affairs. And frankly, we are living through, as they say in cliched terms, historical times. But stay awake, ladies and gentlemen, and follow the program here, because it's going to be very tough times ahead. Well, ladies and gentlemen, time has come to wish you well. Have a great long weekend, and I shall be back with you in a week's time, Friday, with more of the same, if I can keep awake, 2 a.m. Singapore time. I will be back with you next Friday. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.